We're going to start this week with a wee email.
What a surprise. Wow.
Shaking it up.
This email is from Gabby, and she says, "You've inspired me to finally read round my subjects."
Yay!
See, this is something I wish I had done in school. I wish I'd actually cared about learning in school
because I
gained a love of learning after school.
It's hard to learn when you're being told to learn.
Yeah, you know? I'm really stubborn that way.
So Gabby says, "Hi guys, I'm currently in sixth form doing psychology, biology, chemistry A-levels and hoping to take biochemistry at university. In order to get into a good uni, I've been told to read around my subjects, which seemed like a very daunting task because I have no idea where to start. Finding your podcast was a breakthrough because although science has always fascinated me, listening to you guys talk made me realize that outside learning isn't just old professors digging through older books and that maybe I can do it too. Science is beautiful and exciting, and maybe more people would be inclined to believe this if some of the intimidation was removed. Anyway, thanks a lot. Love the podcast. Gabby."
Thank you, Gabby.
Thanks,
what
Gabby.
A wonderful way to start our evening.
I completely agree with everything.
Start the show. Hello, and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp and Luke Cupfor.
Hello, Corey. Hello,
I'm
listeners.
I'm Ginger.
To clear up, before we start, I am actually not Corey.
I'm not Corey.
Hang on.
Corey's the Scottish one.
I am not the person called Corey. I am Luke Cupfor. And for some reason, I'm the only person who has a full name on this podcast.
Got to keep my secrets, man.
Yeah.
Hide my identity.
This week, we'll be talking about the two U's and how you are a massive liar.
Why do you look at me when you said that?
What are you calling me a liar for?
I was looking at Corey.
Oh. You're a massive liar.
What? Yeah.
Oh.
Am I a liar?
Yes, you also are a liar.
What were you calling me a liar for, man?
Everyone's a liar.
Are you a liar?
Okay. I am a liar
as well. So
we can't trust anything you say.
You absolutely cannot. Especially things
see
I say.
See you next week. I'm sorry, guys.
Especially things I say.
Have to look in one of your eyes and see what it's thinking.
Did you say Luke?
No, yeah, but it's another word too.
The way he
too.
Says look sounds like, you got the way you look.
As you know, Luke and Luke sound the same.
Speaking of Luke and Luke, how many of you are there in your head?
A few.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You think there's more than one of you in your head?
Yeah, they scream at each other sometimes.
Corey?
There's one brain cell left, man. He's lonely.
So James and Corey already kind of know this story, but I'll recount it for you. Once upon a time, I had a very strange experience. I found that if I focused enough on different parts of my body, I could kind of trick myself into believing that I cut myself off from the rest of my body. So like I'd focus on my right arm and I'd become entirely convinced that I couldn't lift my left arm. And I kind of stopped feeling the left arm and feel totally cut off from it. And I'd feel like I was just existing as the left arm. And as I kind of went into this for a bit, I noticed it wasn't really kind of like the whole body. It was just that I was kind of cutting my sense perceptions in the middle. So like if I was my left arm, I couldn't move my right foot. Or if I was my left foot, I couldn't move my right arm.
I remember it more specifically as you using parts of your body and you could feel the part of your brain that was telling those body parts to do that thing.
Yeah. And
that's what I remember.
Yeah. And it felt like there were these two sides of my brain that had like different perceptions of the world, different opinions on the world, different like fears, different everything. And now I'm not necessarily saying that this is true, that I actually did this, but it felt very real. And like probably like you listening to this and Tori and James looking at me right now, I started getting very worried about myself and thinking I might be crazy or that I'd had suffered some kind of like brain damage or something. And I really want to stress that I don't necessarily believe I actually split my brain in half, but it was a really fun exercise and it was a really interesting experience. And actually whether real or not, I felt like I opened up a dialogue with myself and I could listen to like, oh, what does me think about this thing? What's this me scared of? And then I can kind of talk to myself and reason things out, and I became a happier person.
You're not making yourself sound less crazy, but
no,
I do like it.
I know. I'm very aware that I sound like
so it. I talked to myself and I said, look, what are you scared of?
Sure. One half of me gave the other half a good talking to.
No, it was more just like, where there were things in my life that were creating cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Cognitive dissonance being something where it feels like two things that disagree.
Holding two opposing ideas in your head at once.
Yes. Yeah. And so there were things that were like happening in my life, or things that like I was doing in my life, where like I would have an opinion on me, and me was doing this thing, like, I don't know, say like chewing up loads of bread and making a YouTube video out of it. And then another bit of me was saying that's a really stupid idea, and I would get this cognitive dissonance and not know how to fix it. So this sort of led me into searching on the internet.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
Was there ever any sexual tension between the two of you?
Did you have a good night together?
Was it a little bit of a, no, you know, a little spark?
No, there was never any.
Did we expect a proposal?
There was tension. And there was very much like a, I had this long period of my life, like, well, not long period of my life, but like a significant few months where I really kind of like got into the ethics of like any kind of desire at all. And like, you remember, Corey, because you sat me down.
I so remember this, yeah.
And you sat me down and you were like, you're not letting yourself have any fun ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a point where you were you decided everything based on how good it was. And you were like, I can't do this because it's not good. I'm like, no, just do it. You enjoy it.
Sure.
You wouldn't eat nice things. You wouldn't watch films. You would just...
Yeah. You're almost trying to reduce your pleasure for the sake of...
I was trying to reduce my dopamine, something. Like pointless dopamine.
Yeah.
Any dopamine that didn't have a good or productive meaning to it.
Yeah.
I was like, no.
Yeah. Mm.
I was basically treating myself like I was a dictator of me. It was pretty awful. So this sort of got me into this world where I started Googling it. I started Googling like split brain. Has anyone ever experienced this before? Mm-hmm. And not really. They hadn't. I had just gone.
You were the first.
Not necessarily the first, but it wasn't.
Scientific marvel you are.
I was just going a bit mad.
How unique.
But I stumbled down this kind of giant rabbit hole into the world of the corpus callosum.
That's the thing in the brain.
Dun, 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 dun. James, you seem to know what this is. Could you explain to the audience what
it's
this is?
It's a thing in the brain.
Yes.
No, it's the thing that's down the middle of your brain that connects the hemispheres together.
Corpus means body.
Yes. Ah. And callosum means?
Head,
I
brain.
Don't remember Latin.
It means tough.
tough body.
Tough body.
I got a tough body.
So the corpus callosum is the largest connective pathway in the brain. It's made up of between 200 and 300 million nerve fibers. And basically, it connects your left hemisphere to your right hemisphere to allow the two sides of your brain to talk. If you didn't know that you have two sides of your brain, basically two separate independent brains in your head.
Yeah.
Now you do.
What's the significance of having a left brain and having a right brain?
So the main theory goes that the left and the right brain kind of specialize in different things. Mm. So in most people, the left brain deals with language and speech and also mathematical calculations. And the right one generally handles like emotions and also facial recognition. Mm. And so the main, this thing is called contralateralism.
Oh,
that makes sense. Yeah, against sides. Yeah. So the sides are against each other.
So your brain is organized contralaterally, which means that your left side of your brain controls your right side of your body, and your right side of your brain controls your left side of your body.
Right.
And the idea of having these two separate brains means that they can specialize in different things. And also it means you can probably multitask better because you have defined separate sections of the brain for different tasks. And probably, I assume, in early childhood development, the brain maybe sets the size of these areas that are designed for different tasks based on the amount of time that you use them, or the amount of intensity you use them with, or whatever.
It's like a supercomputer. That's how they work. You split tasks between different nodes of them, and you use more for bigger tasks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So In 1955, Ronald Myers, who was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, proved that the function of the corpus callosum was to do with coordination and complex problem solving. And basically what this threw up into the scientific world was it threw up this idea of, well, if we could sever the corpus callosum, then we could start finding out what the different parts...
Right, because they wouldn't be able to talk to each other.
Yeah. I love people. Like, we've discovered this amazing thing. Let's break it and see what happens.
Let's break it and see what happens, yeah.
Well, actually, for once in my life, I'm proud of the early scientists because they didn't do this. They didn't go around like severing random people's corpus callosums as they normally do.
Yeah, with so unlike them.
What they did was...
give me a vulnerable person, just...
Yeah, sure.
So basically what they did was sometimes it is medically necessary to cut these two hemispheres apart. It is called a corpus callostomy. Would you like to explain why that's funny, please, Corey?
It just sounds like something that has something to do with poo. That's all. That's why it's funny. I'm simple.
What, colonoscopy?
No.
Brain poo.
Colostomy.
Okay.
Well, oh, yeah, of course.
Which isn't a funny thing. It's just odd that the brain and, you know.
Anyway, a corpus callostomy is the last resort in treating, like, really bad epilepsy called refractory epilepsy. And basically what happens in this is that a kind of magnetic or electronic storm starts in one part of the brain, and because your brain runs on electricity to communicate, it kind of, that signal kind of bounces around the brain everywhere. And if you cut these two hemispheres in half, then it means that if the brainstorm starts in one area, it doesn't spread everywhere. It stays just in like the one, at least it's in one hemisphere, and you still have one functioning hemisphere.
Yeah.
Which incidentally, this is why the term brainstorming was replaced with mind mapping. I remember when in my childhood, anyway,
mind map is something different to me.
Yeah, well, those are two different things.
It might be a different thing, but in my childhood, we were told by our teachers one day, you can't call it brainstorming anymore, because that's apparently offensive to people with epilepsy.
Oh, I do remember that in primary school, yeah. But mind maps are different. They're fun and useless.
Interestingly, as I said earlier about the left hemisphere being generally used for language and speech, etc., and the right hemisphere being facial recognition, in left-handed people, this is often flipped. They have what is called a heterogeneous brain organization, which means that either what we would call a left brain is actually their right brain and vice versa, or that in some left-handed people, both sides of the brain deal with a lot of the same stuff, and they've got a kind of better, just a different organization of brain. I have a theory on this, which I wanted to test with Corey. So, if I am,
Fight?
No. Okay, so my theory is, imagine I were a left brain, and I'm looking out of my right eye.
Right.
Or where I'm actually, technically I'm looking out of the right field of both of my eyes.
Okay.
So, oh God, I'm just everywhere. So the left brain doesn't actually see out of the right eye. It sees out of the right-hand side of both eyes.
So visual processing doesn't happen in one side of the brain. It's split across both.
Yes.
It is split across both.
So my theory is that if I am a left brain right now, right, and I'm looking at the right side of your face, right, it would be a good evolutionary tactic for my left brain to try and figure out what your left brain is thinking, because it is a left brain, so it can kind of think in a similar way. And similarly, my right brain would pay attention to the left side of your face to try and figure out what your right brain is thinking. What I wonder is there is a large correlation of like super successful people also being left-handed. And in left-handed people, like I've just said, the left and right brain are switched. And so what I wonder is it possible that that could be explained by the fact that left brain, like people with their brains swapped over, are harder to read by everybody else? So they might be better at business, say. They might be better at poker, because they're analyzing their left. They are simulating the internal state of the opposite person based on an assumption that their left brain is their left brain, whereas actually their left brain is their right brain.
And you're both left-handed.
I don't know. I'm right-handed.
Are you?
Yeah. I hate left-handed people.
I'm also not. I'm right-handed as well.
Yeah.
Why did I think both of you were left-handed?
Because we're successful.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
No, I do. I hate left-handed people. They're weird. I don't. It's
my dad's left-handed.
Just use your right. My mum's left-handed.
They can't.
Yes, they can.
Their motor center is flipped round.
In the Victorian era, they forced them to.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
How did that go?
Fine. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose. You just whip them with enough sticks and they start doing it.
Stop.
I'm not kidding. It happened. Oh. I don't know enough about brains to say one way or the other. I do have a similar theory.
Okay.
Well, the same endpoint, but a different route. Hmm. That left-handed people are obviously, there are a lot of successful left-handed people. And I was thinking more because you find that left-handed people can use both sides of their brain for like shared tasks. Whether that helps them think more laterally, which gives them an edge because they think outside of the box.
Right.
And approach problems in a way that people that are only using, say, one half of their brain.
Yeah.
Normally would.
Right. Mm. Interesting theories. Anyway, so back to corpus callosum. After you cut the hemispheres apart, each hemisphere will have its own separate perception of the world, its own ideas and its own desires or whatever, like how to describe their experience of the world. They'll now form that information based on just whatever the left brain does or just whatever the right brain does without then comparing data.
So I don't know if you answered this. Does the brain process visual information in one hemisphere or is it split across both hemispheres?
So it's split across both hemispheres, but because, you know, there's that old kind of like mostly debunked idea that you have like the left brain's creative or the right brain's, yeah, or whatever, I can't remember which way around. But it does have some credence towards, like, for example, the left brain thinks mathematically. And so they are both able to see, they're both able to process visual data, but the conclusions they may come to based on that data may be different.
Different, yeah.
But they process different visual data.
Yes.
So and then they put it together across.
They've done experiments with that, haven't they? Where they've like shown the same thing to two.
So this is where we're going.
Oh, okay.
Is it not normally going? Okay.
No
okay.
Spoilers.
So as you do this, when you kind of cut people's brains in half.
How do they cut someone's brain in half? Do you just,
they just
scrape open their head and like
give it a little slice?
Slice.
Yeah.
Slice down the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
So what do you think happens now? So like a real basic assumption of science, for example, at the moment is that consciousness is generated by the brain. So are these now two people?
I guess, well, in a way.
Okay. People with, what is it? Is
what
it
are we defining?
Dissociative identity disorder, DID, with multiple personalities effectively. Are they multiple people? Or are they
it
one person?
It depends how we're defining people.
So
like different personalities or
it's okay, what, obviously we don't know the answer to this question. It's, yeah, a really difficult question to answer, but purely based on the assumption by science that consciousness is generated by the brain, if you separate these things into two separate entities, they should generate their own two separate consciousnesses.
It's like two
consciousnesses.
It's like a set of conjoined twins.
Yes,
but they're just more conjoined than most.
Sure.
Yeah, I guess if you can give them the same input and they react differently,
yeah,
you could perceive them as two different people.
Although, no, because your brain
it won't be as simple.
No, because
as
your brain beforehand was already doing that. It was just communicating,
just talking
with
to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, so everyone is two people.
So I guess you're already two people.
It's just. So yeah, everyone's two people. They're just not talking.
Well, they're just
anymore.
Two half people.
So
whoa, let's not go there.
But if everyone's two people, then that would suggest that what you call I, what you call experiencing, right?
Yeah.
That there is somebody else in your head also experiencing with you.
No, I feel like that a lot. Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I'm pulled. It's like I feel like I'm pulled out of my experience, and I'm experiencing. Myself experiencing an experience.
Yes, that happens a lot in traumatic situations. People leave their bodies and witness themselves being beaten up. Or whatever.
Not like watching myself, but like I'm aware of the experience.
You are the awareness.
Yeah, I'm aware of the experience and separate from experiencing it.
Yes.
It's not fun.
No.
It
can be fun.
It can be, but it's often very uncomfortable.
It can be interesting.
So in absolutely extreme situations, cutting the brains in half can lead to a condition called alien hand syndrome.
This is the thing.
Do you get like a green hand with little suckers on it?
Yeah, that's
yes!
it. That's actually it.
Cut my brain!
Where one hand seems to fight the other one, like it's being controlled by a totally different intelligence. So, for example, one patient said that as he dressed himself, he pulled his trousers up with one hand. That's the side of him that wanted to get dressed. And the other hand tried to fight that hand because it didn't want to get dressed. He also grabbed his wife with his left hand and shook her violently. And then his right hand came in to stop his left hand to defend his wife.
Wait, which one was he controlling then?
Well,
was he shaking his wife, or was he stopping his arm from?
But I mean, to be fair, you are making a very basic assumption here in that we do any of the things that we do.
Well, yes, but my point being, when he says one of his hands came to,
which one does he think he was doing?
Yeah,
it's not reported. He just reported this as an experience that he had.
I'd really like to know, because it changes my view of this guy.
I mean, as we'll see later on, give you a tease. It's kind of that he's both.
Well, I get that it's both, but which one is the one that talks?
More specifically, okay, well, the one that talks is the left hemisphere, but talking is not everything. More specifically, what it would be to be both would be, I think, this is not going off an experience, but I'm just going to imagine it in my head, is that he's almost living in two simultaneous conceptual universes, mm-hmm. one in which the person he calls his wife is somebody he's frustrated with, and one in which the person he calls his wife is somebody he loves and wants to protect. And he's simultaneously living in both universes. Like if I put a VR glasses on your head and played a different movie to each of your eyes, but all the characters in both the movies were the same character through different interpretation lenses.
Oh, like, so it's two movies, right, but all the actors are the same. They're just playing different characters.
Yes, and all the dialogue's the same as well, but the way you interpret it is different.
It is the same.
That's
movie.
So you know how, like, someone can say something, like, completely offhand. And
give me my mug!
Yeah,
give me my mug.
And I hallucinate, like, oh, Corey's really angry at me because I took his mug, and, like, that's not actually happening, necessarily. I think that's the case, and we're going to get to this a little bit later.
Imagine how weird it would be, right? So he's obviously saying he tried to pull on his trousers, and his hand tried to pull it off. Imagine being the other brain that was like, why the hell do my trousers keep on coming up? Just
get, like, stay down, please.
Like, just one hand is pulling on trousers, or one hand is, like, choosing stuff, and you're like, no, I don't want this.
Yeah. These trousers, I can't take them off.
Yeah, like, you, and you're not even able to see, so you're only able to see out one eye, so you're not even seeing the other hand. You're just like, why do these trousers not?
I do wonder if, because only the left hemisphere has the ability in most people to decode speech, I do wonder whether, like, at some point in after the diagnosis or after the operation's been done, do they, like, have a way of communicating to the right hemisphere? Because the right hemisphere can read, for example. Do they hold up a sign saying, by the way, we've cut your other brain off, things are going to get really strange? Because that would be like, because it can't hear.
Yeah.
Well, it can hear, but it can't process audible language.
Yeah. Imagine just suddenly, this is like a Black Mirror episode, by the way. This is amazing. So here's a story. Imagine you you go in for an operation.
Yeah.
And suddenly you wake up and you've got locked-in syndrome.
Yeah.
But the rest of your body doesn't. It's like, it feels like, hold on. Let me do that again. Imagine you go in for an operation, right? And you wake up and suddenly you're deaf. Well, you're not quite deaf. You just can't understand
what's going on.
You just hear anything. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, you're hearing like the Charlie Brown, like, parents noise whenever you see anything. And one entire half of your body is not doing what you want it to do. And you can't tell anyone this because you can't speak. You're just locked into your own body, only able to control, like,
but it is being controlled by someone.
Yeah, and you've just got to go along with the someone else, and who is in my body.
Oh,
it's you. Oh, that's awful.
I've been possessed.
So here we get to the fun part. In 1968, a researcher called Roger Sperry decided to study a group of people who'd had this operation to cut their brains in half. He sat the subjects down and he asked them to cover one eye. So do this with me. Cover one eye.
Anyone?
Not my eye. Stop it. Cover one of your eyes. No, Corey, one eye. Okay. Pick a point to stare at.
Actually, there's two eyes if you've been listening to what you're saying.
Actually, there's three eyes.
Pick a point
I'm
to stare
at. I'm covering my third eye.
Oh my God. Covering my third eye. Okay, I've lost my place in my notes now. Pick a point to stare at.
Yeah.
And then what he would do is Corey, I just saw you move your eye. Pick a point to stare at.
I'm staring at your nose.
Okay, stare at my nose. James, stare at my nose.
Okay.
Right. What he would do is he would flash a word or a picture to the right of the dot that you're staring at, and it would go away, and then only one half of your brain would have seen it, and then he would ask you what you'd seen. So imagine that a word or an object appeared to the right of that point. Only your left hemisphere would see it. Your left hemisphere is responsible for language and speech, and so you would be able to easily say that object or word, right? Now, imagine instead something appeared to the left of the image. Only your right hemisphere would see it. With me so far?
Yes.
Yes.
If I then asked you, did you see something? You would say, with your mouth, no. But if I gave you a piece of paper to your left hand that's controlled by your right hemisphere, you would be able to draw the thing that you saw, even though you said with your mouth that you didn't see anything.
Oh, that's weird.
That is so strange.
Right.
I'm going to uncover my eye now.
Is that only if you've had your brain split?
Yeah, because yes, otherwise... Yeah.
In your case, having an intact corpus callosum,
they'd be able to talk to each other.
They talk to each other. They share the data all the time.
Yeah.
And while I think there may well be for example, if your left hemisphere passes stuff to your right hemisphere that your right hemisphere completely disagrees with, it maybe will just ignore it. But most of the time, I would imagine it's incorporated pretty well, and your brains kind of trust each other, and you're doing all right.
Yeah,
Must be awful to have that and then get really angry at something because you won't know why necessarily.
Yeah.
You have to make up a reason. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't read anything necessarily that had too much of people having really, really drastic negative experiences from this. And we'll see a little bit more about this later. Because the thing is that these experiments are very specific. For example, they're flashing something into the right hemisphere only. But in the real world, if something was there, your brain would compensate and would just move its head or its eyes around so that the left hemisphere could also see it.
Yeah.
I just feel in the case of feeling a really strong emotion, obviously normally your brain is able to communicate with itself.
Mm.
But in this case, it wouldn't be able to. So your left brain would have to figure out a reason why it's so sad. It's
now.
Why am I sad? This bottle in front of me.
Is that why you said we're liars?
This is why you're liars. And now we're going to get to this a little bit later on because I need to walk you through a few other things before we get there. But essentially, yes,
okay.
Your other hemisphere does just make up something to sort of see, to try and figure out what's going on. And it's also really bad at it. When it doesn't have access to the data to cross between them, it's just dreadful.
No, it's not the creative side. It's the logical side. It can't imagine.
So this gets even weirder if you were to flash two pictures at the same time. So imagine, again, you're staring at this dot, and rather than one picture appearing either side, you have two pictures flash in front of you, and each picture only goes to one hemisphere. So imagine I flashed a picture of a cat on the left side and a pan on the right side. The person will say that they saw a pan whilst drawing a cat with their left hand.
Oh, that's weird. I don't like that.
Yeah.
That is so strange.
So in the book Homo Deus by Yuval Noah Harari, he talks about this study, and he talks about a study of a teenage boy with his corpus callosum cut, and he was asked what he wanted to do when he was older. He was asked this of his left hemisphere. He was asked this of his left hemisphere, and his left hemisphere said, "I want to be a draftsman." Now, remembering the left hemisphere is the one that sort of deals with sort of more logical
maths and
mathematical, that kind of thing. And so that's the answer he gave. Then his right hemisphere, they wrote down on a piece of paper, "What do you want to be when you're older?" and showed it to his right hemisphere. And his right hemisphere got some Scrabble tiles and spelt out "automobile race." He wanted to be a race car driver. Well, you have to remember that the right hemisphere is able to do this, but it's also not the main language processing center. So he was probably writing out in the best way it could. I don't know quite how. Where maybe it's just don't know.
You said that the right brain does facial recognition.
Yes.
Have they found that people find it difficult to remember people's names? With speech. So if they were to see someone that they knew, they wouldn't be able to remember their name and say it, but they'd be more able to write down the name. Because the same part of the brain that deals with write, that can write,
yeah,
does facial recognition, but it doesn't speak.
Well, okay, so there was a further study. So the guy who did this study, who was called, he was called Roger Sperry. So now Roger Sperry had a student who later on in 1983 did some more research called Michael Gazzaniga, who was a student, and he did further experiments that showed that when shown faces to different hemispheres, the right hemisphere was way better at even just recognizing and remembering these people. Mm-hmm. So I'm not even sure, based on your question, I'm not even sure if the left hemisphere was reliable at even remembering the faces, so then couldn't name them in any of the ways that you were describing. Only the right hemisphere, or predominantly the right hemisphere, was able to remember and recognize faces.
So you'd be able to write down someone's name, but not tell them what it
without
was.
Without passing that across through the corpus callosum to the left brain to say the name. So it's possible that these kind of things are part of what face blindness...
I was about to say there is a condition.
Generally memory problems, like not being able, like a name's on the tip of your tongue. Because what happens with this is that if somebody, say, for example, with their right hemisphere sees a tree, they know what a tree is, they know how to interact with a tree, they know what a tree does, but the word would just be like right there and they just can't say it. And that's probably, that experience is maybe something to do with these hemispheres not having conversations.
Imagine being your left brain and your right brain's like, what's that big leafy thing? And it's like tree. And your right brain's like, I can't think of it.
Just can't remember what's it for the
life
of
me. They've got like little sticks coming off. Tree!
Yeah. But you could draw it perfectly easily.
Like, look, here it is.
Here it is.
Like,
I'll draw it for you.
It's a tree.
What is that?
So now, here's where it becomes a Luke episode of PsyGuys.
So I have actually been doing it this whole time. Yeah. That was my Luke impression, everybody.
So, in 2017, a group of scientists, including a famed neuroscience and consciousness researcher called Victor Lam, co-authored The Split Brain Phenomenon Revisited, in which they said, I've got a quote for you, in extensive studies with two split-brained patients, we replicate the standard finding that stimuli cannot be compared across the visual fields, indicating that each hemisphere processes information separately. With me so far?
Yeah.
So in 2017, they've replicated this study and they've gone, yes, when you split it in half, it is indeed the brain is processing these separately. And the lack of ability to communicate means not all functions are there. Yet, crucially, we show that the canonical textbook findings that a split brain patient can only respond to stimuli in the left half visual field with the left hand, and to stimuli in the right half visual field with the right hand and verbally, are not universally true. With me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Across a wide variety of tasks, split brain patients with a complete severing of the corpus callosum, totally cut, showed full awareness of presence and well above chance level, so more than randomness, recognition of location, orientation, and identity of stimuli throughout the entire visual field, irrespective of response type, i.e. left hand, right hand, or verbally. These findings suggest that severing the connections between the two hemispheres splits the visual perception, but does not create two independent conscious perceivers within one brain. So remember the first question I asked you?
It suggests that
cutting the brain into two different sections
doesn't make two people.
Despite the fact that the brain is effectively cut in half, quote, a split brain patient is one conscious agent, i.e. you don't become two separate people. This challenges the prominent theory of consciousness, since it implies that communication between the hemispheres is not needed for conscious unity. They experience two parallel, unintegrated streams of information, i.e. like I said to you, they're like living in two conceptual worlds. In addition to changing our view of the split brain phenomenon, this new model poses a serious challenge to the current dominant theories of consciousness.
So does that almost suggest that the consciousness is separate from the brain entirely?
Or that's how I read it. They've worded it very carefully so as not to be too transgressive.
Yeah.
But I read that as there are, I've never actually been able to find them, but whenever talking about the corpus callosum, it always says it is the main way that the hemispheres communicate. Mm-hmm. But what he's what they are essentially suggesting here is that the idea that consciousness arises from the exchanging of information from different parts of the brain isn't necessarily true and is potentially disproven by the fact that the subjective experience of the conscious person is that they are still in both brains, almost like consciousness is like a field around the brain, and they experience the internal state of the brain, and because they can't communicate, they just experience two separate worlds simultaneously, but the consciousness is experiencing the brain, not part of the
brain.
It's
like an already generated consciousness experiencing both perceptions rather than those two brains generating its own consciousness.
Yes.
Yeah. So where the hell does consciousness come from?
Well, we don't know.
We don't know. I don't like it.
The second really big takeaway that I wanted to take from this story is that you're a massive liar.
Why do you look at me again?
I don't appreciate all this slander on
the it's very rude.
Yeah, Corey, I did actually look at you again. I think it's because I'm not used to having eye contact with James because he doesn't host the podcast. I'm going to talk to James. James, you're a massive liar and I hate you. Back to Yuval Noah Harari's book, Homo Deus. He talks about the struggle to find your, quote, true self. When he's talking about... Corey just rolled his eyes.
I've been there.
So he's talking about these separate parts of the brain and he's talking about how basically there are loads of little voices in your brain telling you what to do and what opinions to have. And actually, most people don't even realize these voices are there. They think they are those voices, but they're not. So if you think you're your voice, take a step back. You're not your voice.
You're not the voice.
My favorite kind of like exercise on this is to go, all right, if you're the voices in your head, try and not think for a minute. Deliberately don't think for a minute. Close your eyes, don't think. And I guarantee you'll think a lot, which means you're not your thoughts. Can you stop thinking for a minute?
I don't think it means that you're not your thoughts. I think it just means that you can't stop thinking.
I mean that you're not doing it. Because like my arm doesn't just flail around on its own when I don't do anything.
Yeah, but your heart beats without you doing anything.
Yes. But I didn't say that was my heart. I don't think I'm my heart.
Oh, well, there you are. The voices are coming from the heart.
So anyway, away from that, one patient was shown a picture of a chicken claw.
Claw? Sorry. I wouldn't describe them as claws.
I would.
No, they're just feet.
Okay. Well, I think they are claws.
Okay.
Anyway.
I guess.
Well, this is not really a conversation. Okay, he was shown a picture of a chicken, a little tootsie of a chicken on the left hemisphere, and he was shown a snowy landscape on the right hemisphere. Then he was given a bunch of cards with pictures on to select from and asked to point at the picture which best matched what he saw on screen. Mm. Now remember, his left hemisphere has only seen a chicken claw and isn't aware of the other picture. Yeah. And his right hemisphere has only seen a snowy landscape and isn't aware of the other picture. Both of his hands came out and separately they pointed to a chicken and a shovel. The shovel... It was a landscape, so like mountains, dirt. It's probably the closest thing he had to describe what was on the right hemisphere.
Right.
Now, crucially, the side of the brain with the speech is the left hemisphere. So the left hemisphere has only seen a chicken and pointed to a chicken. So then the researcher asks, why did you point at the shovel? And he says, the chicken claw goes with the chicken and you need the shovel to clean out the chicken shed.
It just made up whatever.
Made up a reason.
People are bad at lying.
Yeah. And then he didn't know he'd made up a reason. So what do you think happened here?
Well, clearly he just made it up. His left brain was, his left hemisphere thought, I don't know why I did that.
Yeah.
So it made up a reason and it went with it.
Yes. In my notes, because he's basically just bullshitting.
Because he doesn't know that the right...
Scientific explanation.
Because the left hemisphere doesn't know that the right hemisphere is like making decisions of its own. Mm.
Yes.
So it's thinking, well, I've definitely made this decision.
So basically what this revealed, this is like, I think there was a Nobel Prize involved in this. But I'm not sure, so don't quote me on that. But it's described...
I think there was a Nobel Prize involved in this. Luke Cuthbert, 2020.
It's described in the book as the million-dollar question, which I figured. I think he also is a Nobel Prize winner. So my left hemisphere, who's narrating this, put two and two together and went, probably a Nobel Prize winning discovery then.
Your left hemisphere is a liar. Why don't you find out? Why don't you find out?
Okay.
What's his name?
Why are you making stuff up, huh?
Yes, he won a Nobel Prize in 1981 for his work on split brain research. So I was right. Thanks, left brain. You did a good job there.
You were right this time.
Ah, I was left this time. Anyway, so what this revealed is that the left hemisphere. So what this revealed.
Your left hemisphere is not very good at its job.
No,
it's really not.
So what this revealed is the left hemisphere is not only the home of our speech, but also is the home of a kind of like internal interpreter that tries to kind of make up a story about our life.
Like your internal monologue.
Like your internal monologue. Mm. And it doesn't always know what's going on, a bit like our prime minister.
Look, the funny thing about this is that it will always be topical.
Yeah.
No matter who the prime minister
is. Yeah, that's true. And so in the left hemisphere, there is this thing that kind of just observes the world and tries to kind of weave out a story out of the stuff that it knows. And that's a lot harder when you're missing half your entire brain. But that thing still exists in us and is still, in the opinion of Yuval Noah Harari and also in the opinion of the people who ran this study, it's still active in everybody else. And it's everyone else in the world still makes stuff up, kids themselves into thinking things, believes in stuff that's not real, like money,
your country.
Like, was that how your memory doesn't exist? Your memory, the more you remember a memory, the less accurate it becomes.
Yeah.
And I guess it's why things like cognitive dissonance exists and why humans like to rationalize things.
Yeah.
What I hate about this is that when we start to study brains, it's your brain studying a brain and it's doing all of this stuff, but it's very bad at actually knowing what it's doing.
Yeah.
Like while we're talking about this, our brains are doing all of these things.
Yeah.
But also, they just don't know what's going on.
No.
No, not really.
What's especially sort of, to me, haunting, if that's the word, about this.
Is you're going to say horny.
So much of like my experience and my basis and your basis for the world is based on what people say. And I guess that comes back to that old thing about judge people on their actions, not on the things they say. And this is kind of like scientifically proving that if somebody's just kind of spewing a lot of crap, it's not necessarily them doing it. They have this substructure in the brain that is basically there to preserve a story in your mind of who I am, where have I been, what's my experiences, what do I represent, all those kind of things. And it doesn't actually necessarily have to be true. The most important thing is that it kind of, it's the best story it can do for you. It makes you look as good as possible. Mm. So in the case of this boy who pointed at a chicken and also pointed at a shovel, rather than just admit, I don't know why I did that, it needed to make a reason and appear smart and whatever and go, oh, well, because you need the shovel to clean out the chicken coop.
Obviously.
Rather than just go, I don't know, that's strange behavior, actually.
Yeah.
Like, it just never does that.
Yeah.
How strange does behavior need to get before your brain's like, okay, something's up.
Something's up here. You can go pretty weird.
Well, you're slapping yourself in the face. You're like, I'm hitting a fly.
There's a reason for this.
In another story like this, a woman was flashed a picture.
A woman was flashed?
Well, actually,
goodness me.
A woman was flashed some pornographic images.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
So, yeah, a woman was flashed, literally, to her right hemisphere. And every time that happened, she laughed. And she was asked why she laughed. And she said, one of the machines in the room looks very funny.
Well, she's not wrong.
What?
Wait, hold on. Is the image being shown on a machine, or
yes,
is it
I
being shown on a
the machine is technically, but she, yeah. So she was creating this story as to explain her behavior, basically. So what this is called, what Yuval Noah Harari calls it in his book, is, and also I think it's called this in sort of general neuroscience, is it's called the narrating self, which isn't necessarily interested in what's truth. It's just based. It's just interested in building a story that kind of makes sense to you. So
Donald
you can carry
Trump.
On. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking of the whole time.
Yes, but everyone. I think everyone's got, like, many people have false memories. Mm. We all have, like,
I mean, we all have false memories.
Anything where you consider yourself to be, like, have done something really well. So, for example, if you achieve something, you tell yourself a story that you achieved it because of things you did, completely ignoring the fact that loads of things could have gone wrong and didn't. And you didn't do any of the clearing away of all the stuff that could have gone wrong. Mm. But you tell yourself this story to make yourself feel good about yourself and to sort of explain the world, because it's far too complex otherwise.
It's kind of like how cold reading works. Cold reading preys on that.
Does it?
Yeah, so cold reading is it's what fake mediums. Psychics, mediums do, wherein so they'll come into a room and they'll say, "Oh, I'm feeling a presence here. Has anyone lost an older man?" And they'll just say something really broad, and then the people that are, you know, they've got their little narrating story. They're like, "My granddad was an old man."
and then they're
like, "It's me." And they're like, "Yes, you. He wants you to say something about the money." Everyone worries about money. Right. Everyone has older relatives that end up dying. You say something broad and your brain makes up a story.
On exactly. This, there's a really good play I went to see with Rebecca recently called Magic Goes Wrong. If you've ever seen, like, they've got this whole series of plays.
Oh, the play,
like,
that goes wrong.
The play that goes wrong. Peter Pan goes wrong. Yeah. And they've got a new one called Magic Goes Wrong, in which they have this guy who keeps coming back as a performer who's like a mind reader. And it is so funny. So funny. He tries to do like a... like, I'm going to guess your job thing. I won't ruin it for you in case you go see it, but very, very good. Anyway, so the narrating self is put at odds in the book with the experiencing self. Mm. So, like, if you are narrating to yourself, telling yourself things on top of a situation, like, for example, Corey says, "Why did you steal my mug?" And my brain goes, "Corey hates you. Corey thinks you stole this other thing that you didn't steal. Corey, all this other stuff."
I think you just have anxiety.
Yeah, sure. But this is my point, is that the narrating self is probably a large part of what causes our anxiety.
Absolutely.
It's the anxious narrator in our head. And you also have the experiencing self. And the experiencing self would be just taking the scenario in isolation to the rest of your life, ignoring the past and future. What's happening right now? Corey's asking me if I took his mug. I did take his mug. I can offer it back. That's it. And you kind of shut out this narrator that now, with science, has been proven to be wrong most of the time. And that's what's so exciting about it is this narrator, this is what I want to talk about. And why
maybe that's what just what the other narrator has told everyone, huh? The ones that are studying, there's another narrator. He's like, "That narrator's wrong. But
I'm right.
I'm right." Oh, what a sneaky play by those narrators.
Hey, kid, you want to buy a narrative?
So according to Yuval Noah Harari, most people are identifying with this narrating self, which is, as we've seen, a self that has at least the capacity to make up a story that's not necessarily the truth. And it's not that I think that your story or my story is necessarily wrong. It's just that it starts to sow a little seed of doubt in your mind of, like, this is not 100% true necessarily. Mm. And that, to me, like, I've had anxiety and extreme paranoia about a year ago, and breaking that pattern of necessarily just believing the thoughts that pop up into my head was life changing. So, quick question for you, just to test you a little bit. If you had to experience pain at the scale 10 and remember it, or pain at scale 20 and you would forget it, which one would you choose?
Oh, man. Luke asked me just before the podcast, and I answered, but he didn't tell me why he asked. So I'm going to let you answer first. I've already answered for him.
So James said...
I would say scale 10 and remember.
10 and you remember.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I said.
Okay. Cool. And second question. Would you rather go and have the most blissful, beautiful holiday you could ever experience, but you forget it, or... a holiday, kind of like an average holiday, where you kind of have a good time, you get a bunch of pictures to show off to your friends, but you come back and you do remember it?
A difficult, awkward question. When you say I forget it, I don't have any of the good feeling from the experience, or is it like it never happened?
To the experiencing self, which is no longer experiencing it after it's finished, you no longer remember it.
Okay. Well... okay, so in that case, I'm going to go the opposite way and do the average one, but remember it because it makes more sense. Because otherwise, it's just a wasted experience because it no longer exists because nothing exists.
I said the really good holiday.
I think the really good holiday.
Yeah, I said to take the really good holiday.
The thing is, if you can't remember something, then it doesn't exist.
But you do experience it when you experience it.
Yeah. Yes, but that's irrelevant.
No, it's
what's
not.
What's the point of life then? You're not going to remember it when you
die. So the key thing here is
you're not going to remember anything. My point is that nothing means anything. So I'd rather remember an average time than have a great time that didn't happen.
But it did happen.
The truth doesn't exist. If you don't remember something, then it didn't happen. Look, here's the thing. If no one remembers something,
yeah,
it didn't happen.
Well,
if everyone thinks that something happened,
okay,
then it did. Because because memory is fallible, we don't actually know anything
So because memory is fallible, if people have a false memory of something, that doesn't mean it actually happened.
I mean, if everyone has the same false memory, then yeah, it did.
No.
Functionally, yes, it did.
No. That's how propaganda works, Corey.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
It means that they act as if it happened. It does not mean it happened.
I think that, honestly, there's not enough of a difference for it to make it doesn't make a difference to your life.
Okay. Well, so the point of those questions, and I hope you answered along at home if you were listening. The point of those questions are to kind of determine whether you are living in your narrating self or your experiencing self.
If you did answer those questions, tweet us and tell us what you answered.
And it's not so much that there's not like right answers or wrong answers. Most people are living in their narrating self. Most people would choose to have more pain and not remember it because they don't want to have the narrator remember the pain.
Yeah.
And most people would choose a holiday that they can show to their friends and that they can have happy memories of rather than actually experience the really good thing in this exact moment. Now, I'm not going to say one is correct and one is not correct. I think that would be not fair. But I do think that anything that allows you to disconnect or disidentify with the narrator, although it closes down the possibility of you being able to tell yourself nice stories, it also closes down the possibility of your brain being able to tell you horrible stories, which I think is the root of like anxiety and depression. And so my final takeaway from this episode,
Chinese.
Personally, my final takeaway has been two things. Firstly, it gives us a glimpse towards the fact that the scientific dogma that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain is potentially crumbling. And I wanted to share this story as well with anybody suffering from like mental health conditions, that there is a little voice in your head making up stories that aren't necessarily true. Now, I know that that will have been communicated to you by a therapist potentially, or read in a self-help book or whatever. But it's also so incredibly empowering to know that science has also proven that to be true. Because then it's not just a nice story you're telling yourself to feel better. It's an objective truth that the thing that's making you suffer isn't you.
And it's also probably wrong.
And it's also probably wrong, yeah. Exactly. So Yuval Noah Harari says, when humans say I, generally they mean the story in their head, not the stream of experiences that they undergo. We identify with the inner system that takes the crazy chaos of life and spins out a seemingly logical and consistent yarn. It doesn't matter that the plot is full of lies and it's written again and again, and that it's rewritten again and again, so that today's story flatly contradicts yesterday's story. The important thing is that we always retain the fiction that we have a single unchanging identity from death to birth. And I think that this experiment proves that that's not true.
Do people think that they've got a single identity?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Me.
Well, they'll be like, I am this thing and this thing, but it's still sort of a, like, I would be a vegan for a while, right? I would identify as a vegan. Mm. Not eating flesh is who I am.
That's weird. This is something that's always really weird to me. There's people that, and this is not against people like this, but there's people who say in their Twitter bio have everything. They're like, I'm disabled, I'm gay, trans, this,
oh,
that,
yeah, all
every single thing that they fit into, vegan, car lover. I'm like, dude, man, you're more than that.
I used to be like that four or 5 years ago. And thinking back to that, I'm like,
the fact that any person, and it's great finding comfort in labels, but it's terrifying to me to think that someone can easily quantify themselves by
it's like you're more
such a finite number of labels.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I'll tell someone that I would never, that's the thing. I would never say that I'm a podcaster. I'll say I do a podcast.
I have a podcast that I do.
This is an aspect of me. It doesn't define me.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of the way that you use language to define yourself, it's very interesting. Like, would you call yourself?
I wouldn't do this now, but it is an easy trap to fall into when you are somebody who doesn't know who they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you don't know,
you feel like
you need to know who you are.
Yeah, but you don't.
The truth is,
it's very easy
to get
attached to labels.
Anything. Mm. You are just the experiences you're having. And that's a really hard thing to get over until you realize how empowering that is. Because it also means that right now, you're not your past. Any of the things that happened to you,
you can be anything.
You aren't those things anymore. And as long as more bad things aren't happening to you, then you're not bad things. So I'd like to kind of end on the fact that, like, I hope that this episode showed you, to a certain extent, through scientific experiment, that you can start to ignore that little inner voice in your head. It is okay, because it's also wrong most of the time. And you can start putting your identity and experience back into what's happening right now. And keep the little narrator for when it's helpful and when it's useful. But most of the time, it's dysfunctional. Most of the time, it's dysfunctional and it's just there
and
to cause you pain.
It lies to you. Yeah.
And it lies!
It lies to you.
So you're not a liar. Your brain is.
My brain?
Yes, Corey.
Yes, your brain!
Stop lying to everyone, Corey! Thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday, and why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support us on patreon.com/SciGuys. Find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
I'm not Corey everywhere.
I'm Coupled everywhere.
I'm Jamkin everywhere.
Goodbye.
Bye to both of you.
Ooh. Ooh.